I always get the jitters before I speak to people. My dad and my brother are preachers, and I don't know where they ever got the knack for it to be able to speak naturally before a crowd of individuals. I'm always nervous because I feel like I overanalyze, I overthink, don't want to misspeak. I know that it's not about who I'm speaking to, that I'm not trying to offend people, but trying to speak truth and making sure that what we say is right. And I just think about opportunities like this to not just pass by as like, you can just say whatever and it'll be okay. You know, there's some gravity to speaking and trying to present some thoughts, and hopefully what I have to say tonight will be helpful to you. I try not to be too negative, as in too condemning, but also try to be uplifting. So if you feel like, man, he's being really hard, try to find things maybe that I'm saying that'll be uplifting. But if you think, man, he's always just saying good things out there, maybe you should find things that are hard to handle at times. That sounds backwards, but that's true. Sometimes we need to find things that challenge us. I appreciate Elijah giving me an opportunity to speak after hearing him this morning. It's kind of like, sometimes you wonder why people would even want to when you're on the spotlight. And, you know, man, if you're the one saying it, you need to be owning up. You know, if you're going to be telling people to live this way, you need to live this way, right? And that's tough. That's tough because you're putting yourself under a lens for everyone to say, well, yeah, but this guy, I mean, he's talks a big game, but how does he handle this? And so that kind of rolls into some things we're going to talk about here. And so with that being said, Elijah invited me to speak. And you guys are studying Acts, right? Up to chapter 17 right now. So it shouldn't have been too long ago that you studied chapters 13 and 14, Paul's first missionary journey. Now, in light of the current circumstance, I want you to remember this, the Jews were all excited about the message of Paul. They invited him to speak. But it wasn't until he started inviting them Gentiles that they were ready to string him up, to go out and stone him. In fact, in another city, they got him so riled up, they did stone him and left him for dead. But he got up, shook off the dust off his feet, went to another city, continued to teach and to preach the same message. So, if there's anything that I have to say here that you're like, man, we need to get that guy, just think, you might have at one point gone, you know, I agree with him. And if that perspective changes, just think, well, maybe, hold on. Paul didn't change his message. He was offering salvation to all people, and they were all for it. But what changed? Well, their perspective changed. The message was the same thing, but their perspective of Paul changed. Oh, well, he's offering this to Gentiles. Now we can't accept that. You'd all be for something you were against if it put an Arkansas Razorback logo on it, right? Oh, did I step on some toes there? But I want you to think about I want you to think about that, though, that like in this cartoon, you know, someone looking from a completely different perspective sees something totally 100 degrees, 180 degrees out of focus from the other person. And so the point to you is that this is the case for all of us, that we see things differently than others. Oh, earth-shattering. But it's true, and though we admit to it, sometimes that's hard for us to handle. It depends on who you're talking to. It may be a trivial thing that I'm not a Razorback fan. And so you may go, oh, no big deal. Okay, why on some other things that you might go, okay, we're not talking about just football. We're talking about more serious things that we could disagree on. We could have different perspective on, and how then do we handle it? Now that's different, isn't it? Well, I put forward to you a couple individuals here. I think the majority of us here might feel the same way about this particular situation. Who's the traitor? George Washington, our first president, right? We're all U.S. citizens, I believe. Or Benedict Arnold? Ooh, nobody likes him, right? Why is that? Well, think how our perspective towards George Washington might change had the states not won the war for independence. We might be talking differently about him if the situation turned out differently. Can you consider that? But you might go, well, okay, yeah, we all would be in agreement, so there's nothing to be up in arms about. We all, I think, would agree George Washington, you know, was a good leader, a good general, but I think a fantastic president. And you look and you read the things that are said about him, the number of articles I've read about him. You're just like, he's so much better of a person than a lot of people portray him as. And then you listen to his farewell address, and it's like, it's almost prophetic in the things that he's saying. It just seems so wise in what he says. But then I want you to think about how we might feel collectively about him. I think the majority of us would feel similar types of things about him. Now, I want you to remember that first slide about Paul. And, you know, the Jews were okay with that as long as it was just speaking to Jews. So you're okay with it as long as I'm talking about George Washington, and we can all agree he might have been a good, really good president. Okay. I want you to think about this. You all know him, right? Abraham Lincoln, the 16th president. What reasons would people have for seeing him differently? I'm from the North. I'm from Illinois. And he was the first elected Republican president, of which a party I tend to associate with. Now, how can my perspective toward him and what he did be skewed? How can I be biased? I can see that. I want to relate to him because he seems like a victor for my side. And how might someone else's perspective be different? So I want you to consider, how deep do our prejudices run just because of how things turned out? Now, I don't want to leave this in this type of talk. We want to look at what the Bible says about perspective. And so I want you to consider, what is true perspective? Is it like the postmodernists say, all views are equally valid? You can think one thing, I can think one thing, they're just as valid as one another. No one has authority to say that one valid or one view is superior to another. You know, we serve Jesus, we serve God of the Bible, but Allah, Buddha, they're all the same, right? I don't believe that. I don't believe that to be true. I believe that there is one perspective, and that's God's perspective, not mine. It's easy for me to spout what my view is and say that it's God's, but that's not necessarily the case. I need to remember that. I may be biased toward my own opinion, but that may or may not be actually what God says about it. But again, realizing that it's God's view, how God sees things in this world, what he says about it, that's right and that's true. And I hope that we can all agree that that is a good basis to begin with when we want to talk about perspective. Because I may not be seeing things right, you may not be seeing things right, but God does. And we need to first begin there. And so he is truth. He is absolute truth. But our purpose is to draw close to what he sees. So how does he view these situations? How does he view these passages? What does he want me to be doing? Not just what I think I should be doing, what you think I should be doing, and vice versa. But like Elijah mentioned this morning about problems with eyesight, we all need spiritual glasses. If you can begin to understand and begin to see that you can't see, that you are blind, Jesus says, then you see. It's kind of like when you begin to get wisdom, it's shown by the fact that you realize that you don't know anything at all. And that is actually a step above the person who thinks they know it all. How true is that? I think we all can see that in a generality, but when we have to get to specifics, how hard that is then to be able to realize, wait, you mean my eyes aren't seeing things that are actually there? Consider someone who is red-green colorblind. If everybody was red-green colorblind, no one would know. But because there's a difference in perspective, there's some analysis that needs to take place. There's some difference there that needs to be balanced out. What is the truth? What color is that really? And that may be really simplistic in an example, but the greater still applies. And so I ask you to just consider, we're all blind, but like the man that Jesus healed. You remember the man that Jesus healed in kind of two phases? He was blind, and Jesus touches him, and he begins to see, but he sees what? Men walking around as trees. Whatever exactly that looked like, I don't know if I can begin to imagine, but we know that it wasn't true vision. He was seeing something, but it wasn't clear. It wasn't the truest of true. But Jesus comes and touches him again, and then he sees clearly. I think the lesson for us in that is that we don't always see it clearly the first time, but we need to keep coming back to Jesus to see more clearly than I did yesterday. And does not mean, though, that, oh, well, the second time I came to it, that I've got it. But that it's a continual process in our growth to continue to see things more clearly, like as God sees them. So not only issues that we would see in the Bible, but one another. How do you view your neighbor? How do you view the fellow Christians here? How do you view your actual neighbors where you live? How do you view evil, wicked people? It's like you could put up a name like Adolf Hitler and be, oh, that's terrible. But I think about several years ago when there was still the conflict in Iraq. And I remember my dad saying a prayer, praying for individuals like Saddam Hussein, that there would be hope that for any of them to be able to see the truth. And someone had condemned him for that. Well, how could you pray for someone like that? Because God, I think my dad, hopefully you would agree with this, but you got a reason for yourself that my dad was saying these are lost individuals. And they may be doing wicked things. And that wickedness, pray the Lord that it stops, but pray that these people can see the light. God wants all to be saved. Don't I? Don't I want to see them just the same as He does? And so that may be things that I think at times can be easier for us to grapple with. Oh, those really terrible sinners, they need Jesus. But what about the individuals that we just minorly disagree with? Minorly maybe have some perspective changes on. I think at times we oftentimes handle those less favorably in those situations than in the greater divide in perspective differences. But I want to use an example here from the Bible that shows one form of this. You remember Joseph was thrown in the pit by his brothers when he was younger. And then years later, Joseph then is able to save his brothers from a famine. And after Jacob, their father, dies, his brothers are really concerned about this because Joseph is in a high position and he could probably just do about whatever he wanted to with them. And they're afraid of him. But then you consider what Joseph says to his brothers in Genesis chapter 50. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for evil which we did to him." They were right to be afraid to some extent because they knew how wicked they had been and that there might be judgment coming upon them. But the problem is the way that they saw their brother. They had a wrong perspective on their brother. Because what did their brother see? I believe Joseph here and his response to them is saying, this is how God sees you and the relationship with me. So they sent messengers to Joseph saying, "Before your father died, he commanded saying, thus you should say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God your father." And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, "Behold, we are your servants." And Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for I am in the place of God. But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about, as it is this day, to save many people alive." They thought there was judgment coming, but from Joseph and from God's perspective, this was all to bring about their own salvation. Consider Jesus in casting out demons. There was definitely a difference in perspective on who and by whose power was doing this. Now you could come to this and say, well, they should have known that he was God. I mean, if he's performing miracles, but even Jesus says, if you don't believe me, even if you think that I'm a blasphemer, believe the works that I do. And so there's another thing that you have to cast into this light of perspective, that it may be one thing to go, you know, this thing that they're saying, I don't know about. This doesn't seem right. But then you also have to weigh that with, but what is the person doing? Are they from God? It doesn't equate one-to-one that if they're doing good works, by their fruits you shall know them. It doesn't always equate that they're approved of God. But you have to give that some consideration. And that's what Jesus is saying here. What am I doing that you are going to condemn me for? And consider how Nicodemus resolves all of this. He may have been one that was like, when Jesus first came on the scene and said, he's acting like he's God. He's got to be blaspheming. But what does Nicodemus say in John chapter 3? No one could do these things except God be with him. And so you can see how being able to witness what a person is doing or not doing may change your perspective of them. So you may at times hear someone, well, it sounds good to me because it's something I agree with, but then they're acting like a jerk to everyone around. You may go, hold on, maybe what he's teaching isn't quite right. I think that would be a legitimate response. I need to maybe question the things that he's doing and question the things that he's saying. But if it's, man, I don't know about what this fellow is saying. You know, it's different than what I've been taught all my life. But he's doing good works. And not to discount what he's saying, but maybe I need to give this a second look. Maybe I need to give him an opportunity to speak and to hear what he has to say. He looks like he's trying to serve God. Maybe my perspective is off. Again, it does not equate one-to-one, but again, there are opportunities for us to change our perspective and that we may be wrong in our perspective. Here's another one that we oftentimes come up against in a different type of example. In our little kids' class, we have kings that have smiley faces and kings that have frowny faces on them. And so all the kings with the smiley faces are the good kings, and all the kings with the frowny faces are the bad kings. And so I propose to you two different ones. Joash, who by most Bible school teaching supply, put a picture of a smiley face with him. If you know the situation with him, he was a good king. He served God until the high priest died. And then he had to turn away from serving God. But we'll say, what? But he did all this good. Well, we should call him a good king. You know, he did some bad things later, but we should call him a good king because of all the good things he used to do. But then we have Manasseh, and there's no one that I've ever heard of that ever disagreed that he was a bad king. But I would propose to you that he was probably one of the best kings in the fact that even all the evil that he did, when he was in captivity and he cried out to God in faith and God brought him back, God saved him, and he tries to turn the hearts of the people back to God. Oh, but all those bad things he used to do, oh, he's doesn't matter how much good he does, he's still going to be bad in my eyes. Can you see how we might treat people like that? How our perspective of people might be skewed because of past performance. What about this situation between David and Saul? Now, I'm not going to say the same thing as we did about Joash and about Manasseh. But I think there's also another avenue in which our perspectives may affect the way that we treat people. So not David and Saul, but consider the relationship you have here. David becomes anointed as king because Saul has been deposed by God himself. And so David will become the rightful king, but at the time, Saul is still God's anointed. And David, even with an opportunity to kill Saul, relents from that. Even though all his men around him tell him, yeah, there's your opportunity, go and kill him. And David says, let not my hand rise up against God's anointed. David has compassion upon Saul. Even when Saul is seeking his own life, and David is the anointed one, the man after God's own heart. But he says, let me not do this. But after Saul dies, some fellows get this bright idea that they're going to come and report this great news to David. And they bring Saul's crown and give it to David. And David's not happy about this. And David has those individuals executed because they did not honor God's anointed as David had. Well, you would think that, well, that would be the end of the story. But Saul's own general, Abner, I believe he was an uncle, that makes a treaty with David, and David allows him to go in peace. Well, he should have been David's enemy, right? But David offers him terms of peace. But Joab, one of David's right-hand men, says, this isn't right. David's the rightful king. He's the one chosen by God. And so he goes and kills Abner. And David is distraught. He says, I am innocent of his blood. This is all on Joab. And he pronounces a curse on Joab. Well, following this, in the next chapter, you have Saul's son Ishbosheth. And some couple fellows get this bright idea. Well, he is David's enemy. You know what would be good to do? Let's go kill him. Wow. So we're going to do this. We're going to kill him on his bed. And then they bring this news to David. Hey, look what we did for you. We killed your enemy. And David said, there were some fellows that thought they were bringing me good news about the death of Saul. But here, a righteous man you have killed on his own bed. And he has them executed as well. And then you also again have his own son Absalom. Absalom, in rebellion to David, usurps David's throne and expels him from the city. And guess who comes up? Joab. Well, David's the rightful king. Well, you know what I need to do about this? He goes, and when it's told him that Absalom is tangled in a tree by his hair, he goes and kills him. And David is distraught over this again. He pronounces this curse upon Joab, and his son Solomon will eventually have Joab executed. But the point of this is that even though these individuals thought they were fighting for the good guy, he's the one, he's the anointed of God, but they displeased that king by the way they treated others. So then consider your perspective on God. How you view God, and how you think God then therefore sees situations, sees Scripture, sees application of this Scripture, and sees people. What does the Bible say? This is God's avenue to speak to us on God's perspective, and you think that you know it. Well, what does the Bible say? So if you think that you know God and you know the Bible in and out, you could recite every single passage in it, do you understand God? Do you really understand God? So if you think that you do, do you justify the mistreatment of others? Such as your fellow Christians or even unbelievers. So I ask you, we have this conundrum that we find ourselves in of we're all blind to some extent, of maybe varying prescription levels. How can I get clearer image of reality, of truth? Of God? How can I see God more clearly? Because I'll tell you, the way I used to view God as a kid is that God was vengeful and wrathful, and that's to some extent true. But even my dad told me, God, he's not looking to just condemn you. He wants to save you. He sent his son to die for you. He is exacting. He is just. But my perspective of him was only that. And I forgot. He's a merciful God also. But that doesn't mean that he's just willy-nilly with his mercy. It doesn't mean that it's just you can be in rebellion to him. That's okay. But we need to have a good perspective of him. Because sometimes we're skewed one way or we're skewed the other way. And we really miss who he is and what he's really saying. And so, therefore, when we read the Bible and we try to interpret the Bible, if we don't understand God, how much more can we misunderstand what he has said? And so, if we don't understand God and we don't even always understand what he says, that's definitely going to skew how then we view one another and how we treat one another. So I would say, beginning with this, recognizing your own biases. I know I mentioned this at the beginning, and I hope this was not, I hope it wasn't too divisive of an argument I was trying to make about Abraham Lincoln, but hope you can see from that I can see my biases. I may not see all of them, but I'm trying. I'm trying to see what my biases could be. So if any time I came into an argument about somebody over Abraham Lincoln, hopefully I could see that how my biases might skew what I would say and what I would think about the situation. But then also spending time to experience someone or something. You want to gain a better knowledge and perspective on God, you need to be spending time with him. You need to be spending time with him in prayer and in reading and hearing his word. But not just hearing. How does James put that? Not hearers only, but doers. I tell you what, that is one of those things that it's easy to be scholastic in your study of the Bible if you consider that easy. It's easy to go through and study the Bible and get every single nuance in the words and have rudimentary knowledge. But it's like on our way down, Katrina and I are listening to this book that I've read before, and I would recommend it to all of you. It sounds ridiculous, but it's called How to Read a Book. And we think that I can read English. I can read letters. I'm really smart. But he calls these people bookful blockheads because they think that they have knowledge when they've read a lot, but they've never really understood. It's one thing to say that you've read the Bible. It's another thing to say that you understand the Bible, especially through application. Because when he says you are to love, you are to forgive, it's a whole nother thing when it's someone owes me $2. I'll forgive you the $2. Someone's got to pay that. Oh, I'll handle $2. What if it's $1,000? What if it's 10,000? What if someone has murdered your child? Whoa, that's a huge leap. But that's exactly it. And our perspective sometimes changes on forgiveness because of how much I have to pay to forgive someone. So don't just be hearers, but actual doers. And I think you will really begin to see God. I'll tell you what. I was trying not to bring up anything about Nina, but being a parent, it changes your perspective on love and how much you're willing to do for someone and how much they may hurt you and try you, but being patient and understanding. I begin to understand God and how He views me when I'm like, I tell her, we're getting you a bottle, give it a second. Stop your crying. We're going to feed you in just a second. It'll be okay. But she doesn't see that. Can you not see how God looks at us? So give it a second. I'm going to bless you. But you need to just wait. Just give it a second. And that experience in and of itself teaches you so much more about God when you begin to not just experience it, begin to practice what He says. That will definitely change your perspective, not just of Him, but also of one another. So I've got a few passages here that I want to end with. But before that, I want to use kind of an example. This is difficult. Because I don't want to end you on a harsh note. But also wanted to be particular about the things that I said. Katrina and I have talked about this. I've talked with a few others. We went through this book from Gardner Hall. I don't know. Does anybody know him? He's a preacher. He's written a book called Conviction Versus Mercy. Has anybody gone through that book before? I don't agree with everything that his application of it, because some people pick on that and go, well, see, that's the very point he's not trying to, that he says he's trying to make, and then he doesn't do that, and I get it, but he's working through some things that are really tough to handle, and he's talking about perspectives, being convicted about something, but then also being merciful to someone who differs in their view of Scripture. This has been a tough book for me. We went through it a few years ago, and it's still working on me. And so I tried to talk about some of these things before a church up there in Illinois. And I said, I didn't even use an example, because I said, we went through probably 20 different things, from abortion, gun rights, all sorts of things, that trying to use this as an example, but trying not to be too offensive that it would be too hard for people to hear. It's kind of like when Jesus says, eat my flesh and drink my blood. You know, and a lot of people stop following because it's too hard to handle. And I'm definitely not in the wisdom of Jesus and how to dispense that and be able to handle those topics appropriately. But I tried to pick at least one here that I thought may not be too controversial. You go, we need to drag out and start, you know, beating people over this one. But it's a relevant one. One of the things Katrina and I did a few weeks ago, it was just last week with my brother Kevin. We invited him to come up so he could see baby girl. It had been a few months since he'd seen her. And we went to a shooting range. Katrina and I had talked about trying to shoot pistols. I have a shotgun. I have a rifle. I got a couple shotguns. And we always did that for hunting and things like that. But one of the things that she and I have talked about since we've been married, it's not something I always thought about before, but with a little girl, self-defense. Hopefully I'm not getting too many blank stares, but you can imagine that not all of us disagree on how to handle that. And the reason I bring this particular one up is because there was a disagreement between myself and another individual back when I was in college. Yeah, it's not very recent, but I think the point still remains. I definitely didn't handle that situation well. He and I disagreed on it, and I was belligerent with him. I called him all sorts of names. How could he think this? This is terrible. Who would want to be married to a fellow like that? It didn't matter what the argument was over. And you find that there's a lot of divisions that come in the church that it's not really about the issue. If only we would really... I'm not saying that it's good that we should argue, but if only we at least argued over really spiritual things... Over this, man, this is not right. We argue over some of the most trivial things. But even in this situation, I can't say that God approves or disapproves. I don't know as well today than what I used to, or what I used to think that I did. But it was about the way that I handled him. It's about the way that I talked to him. It's the way I thought about him. The perspective that I had toward him and toward this issue that wasn't right. Even if I was right, and God said, gave me a stamp of approval, said, this argument is correct, does not justify the mistreatment of others. So I want you to consider a couple passages here from Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3 talks about things that are earthly and keep your mind on things that are above. And some of the things that he mentions here that are earthly are like fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness. And we would go, yeah, that's right. Those are terrible things. Murder, strife, lying. Yeah, those are wrong. Those are a lot more easier for us to identify as wrong. And yeah, we shouldn't be doing those things. And I think James, though, describes some things that are a little bit, not elusive, but a little bit more subversive and easier to sneak into people that think that they're right. Especially here in chapter 3, beginning this chapter about the tongue, that out of the same fount, blessings and cursings can't come. But he ends this chapter, and he says, who is wise and understanding among you? If you want to be wise and understanding, listen to what he says. Let him show by good conduct, and his works are done in meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but isn't just earthly. He says that, but it's earthly and sensual. But those aren't the words that really got to me. These are people who think they're right with God. And what he says about this kind of wisdom, that they think they're right and they think that they can be belligerent in their speech after talking about taming the tongue, and he says, this is demonic. This is of the devil. People who think that they're for God, for the rightful king, but because of the way that they treat others, and it's demonic. But that's not where I wanted to leave you. I don't want to leave you just thinking that, man, this is... I not only have to consider what does the Bible say and make sure that I'm doing what the Bible says about a particular issue, but I also have to bring into this whole realm of the discussion, how do I think and treat someone who I disagree on this subject about? Even if they're wrong and I'm on the right side of this, how do I treat them? And this is what James says is the cure for all of this. It's like we were singing about the fruit of the Spirit. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure. That's tough. It's not just a relationship between me and my wife. It's not just that... It's not just trying to handle these situations right, but I need to make sure that my heart is pure. It's kind of like Jesus, whenever Paul says that husbands are supposed to love their wives as Christ loved the church. Not just in the sacrifice on one day, but in devotion and doing what was right every day. This is the kind of pure we're talking about here. Not just the, okay, I'll try to handle this situation right. I'm going to try to handle every situation the way that God would want me to, so that when I come to be dealing with her, I have the right heart, the right motives, and all the things that I do. I'm trying to do what's right so that anything and everything that may affect her will be right. It's first pure, and then peaceable, gentle, and this next one really hits me hard. Willing to yield. There are some things that we disagree about that I think in the grand scheme of things are inconsequential. But I think this is the best way to do it. And what I hear James saying is, sometimes I need to be willing to yield. That's not always what I want. Being willing to do things for others' sake. It's not sinful for us to do this. Sometimes I need to humble myself and be a servant. Full of mercy and good fruits. You will know them by their fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Just because they've been a dirty, rotten scoundrel most of their life does not mean that it's okay for me to treat them like a dirty, rotten scoundrel. Now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. This is what he's calling us toward. There are so much greater things that we can be actively doing and propelling forward in our lives and in one another, that when we get bogged down by all these squabbles, sometimes over inconsequential things, over a difference in perspective, that we can be united through real things and not superficial. So as we sing a song tonight of an invitation, the feast is prepared and is ready. And I don't want you to just... Well, I've already been baptized. I don't need to think about this. I really want you to think about you. Not in a selfish way, but really thinking about yourself and how that maybe the way that I've treated other people, how I handle situations, it may not always be right. I want you to consider those relationships and that it's not the end of the world. While there is still life, there is still hope. There's still opportunity to repair things. I've heard people say that, well, the relationship was irreparable. And when you have individuals like Manasseh and God is saying, you can repair the relationship with me after 50 years of all the wickedness, of sacrificing children in a fire. He's saying, you can repair that relationship. That's hope. No matter how much I've messed things up, there's hope. And I hope that you'll begin to see one another that way, with love and compassion, even for people that you disagree with, on whatever level the disagreement is. Let us stand and sing.